After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur before Haman, and day after day they cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, and they may put it into the king's treasuries." So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money is given to you and the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you." This is the end of the reading.
Morning. It is so good to be here. All the best movies have a villain. Some of them manage to be lovable, and some of them are just downright bad. And I thought for a bit of fun this morning, we could do a wee picture quiz of some famous villains in movies. So you're allowed to shout out the name of the character and the name of the film. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. Okay, next one. Harry Potter version 17 or whatever the latest one was. Okay, next. From? Okay, next. From? Wizard of Oz. Good. Next. Goldfinger from? Goldfinger, very good. Do you know, I watched it again the other day. Fantastic. Hans, somebody, come on. From, okay, one character has appeared twice. Alan Rickman, in my opinion, the best movie film. Love him. Anyway. The Book of Esther is the most fabulous story. So you could very easily imagine it being made into a blockbuster film. And it certainly doesn't lack a true villain, for a guy called Haman makes his appearance in chapter 3. Some of you may remember our amazing pantomime in Green Island from years ago. Anybody remember that? Anybody remember what it was called? Captain Righteous and the Christmas Crisis. And I got to play a villain, Al Cappuccino. And I hope there are no photographs. Social media wasn't really a big thing back then. Thank goodness. But anyway, Haman was no pantomime villain. He was the real deal. We don't get too many details about him in the story. He just appears as a noble in Susa, whom King Xerxes wanted to honor. Now, some Jewish rabbinic writings claim to fill in some of the background about Haman, and we can't really be sure of their truth. So, for example, it's said that he was a barber. Also that he got into dire straits and sold himself as a slave to none other than Mordecai, which, if it was true, could explain some of the issues later on, but we don't know if it's true. It's also asserted that he was into astrology, based on the way he went about finding the perfect date to slaughter for the slaughter that he planned. But one thing we do know is that he was an Agagite, which likely means he was a descendant of King Agag, former king of the Amalekites. And if you think back to any of you who know Old Testament history, that was a race of people who were regularly at war with the Israelites. Anyhow, we don't know why he was honored by Xerxes above the other nobles, but it was in that honor that lay the root of his downfall. Because as part of how he was honored, others were instructed to pay him respect and to kneel before him. Now, you'd think he should be proud enough of the honor that had been given, but no. Rather than being pleased with his newfound honor and the fact that people bowed down to him and gave him respect, Haman started to fixate on one problem. This nuisance Jew, Mordecai, who refused to bow to him. Now, more Jewish history actually suggests that Haman actually wore the symbol of a pagan deity on his clothes. If that's true, that would explain why Mordecai wouldn't bow down to him. Giving respect to an official was one thing, but giving respect to a pagan deity would be another thing altogether. A bit like Daniel and his friends. We'll find out a bit more about them later on. That was a line too far for a devout Jew. Anyhow, this refusal from Mordecai eventually ate away at Haman so much that he concocted the most evil of plans. Not satisfied with dishing out revenge on Mordecai, he decided he was going to take his temper out on all of Mordecai's people who happened to be Jews. And so started in motion this horrendous attempt to wipe out all the Jewish people from the face of the earth. Not the first time it had happened. Think back to Egypt and the plan to kill all the boy slaves. And it certainly wouldn't be the last time that it has happened. But with apparent ease, Haman manages to suck up to the king and tried to bribe him, didn't need to actually, as it turned out, sufficiently, to get him to agree to this genocide. And off he goes to put the plans in place with royal approval. And having already decided by consulting his equivalent of tea leaves what date it would be, the edict was sent to the whole kingdom decreeing that all the Jews were to be wiped out on one day. Problem solved. It's mind-boggling. And it's evil beyond belief. And it's a perfect illustration of what pride can do. Now, I guess none of us are ever going to be in a position where we have the sort of influence and power that someone like Haman had. But that doesn't mean that we are any less susceptible to the effects of pride and anger, the stuff that cursed Haman. You see, for us, it might be more subtle, and sometimes it's not actually. But we need to be much quicker to realize when our pride could be leading us down a bad path. And yeah, we may not have much impact on the wider world, but our pride can lead us to do untold damage to those around us and to ourselves. Book of Proverbs, this is a famous proverb. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Very easily, pride can become our prison, and eventually also our executioner. How many countries today, even, or down through history, are ruled by evil people prepared to do anything for their own pride, to protect their position? Their pride leading them to engage in the very worst of actions. We see it played out daily. But not just that. How many relationships? How many families? How many businesses? How many churches literally have been destroyed by the pride of an individual that has gotten out of control? No one holding them accountable. And a trail of destruction just left in their wake. You know, I read this story. I hate the idea of a person like Haman. But you know what? Maybe I hate it because I see in myself all the seeds of pride that, if they are left unchecked, cause similar havoc in my relationships and in my world. I was doing some research as I was reading up for today, and I came across this advice from a Christian counselor in how we address the signs of pride. And he asks three questions. I think they're really helpful for us to consider. He asks his clients to address three perspectives, and they're these. Whose faults are you most focused on? Where do you find your joy and contentment? And whom do you serve? And his assertion is this. You must have come across these before, Nancy. If the answers are others, worldly things, and myself, then we are in the grip of pride. And you can understand this. You know, think about it. Whose faults annoy you most? Who needs sorted out the most? Whose sin makes you most angry? If the answer to that question is everybody else's, then we're in the grip of pride. And where do we seek joy? Is it in what God has done for us and how he loves us and the purpose he has given us? Or is it in getting just a bit more stuff? Money, power, significance, success, recognition. Or whose needs are most important to me? My needs or others? I'm so important that the world around me and even God himself should be focused on me. Classic Haman. Classic pride. Too often, classic me. And I suspect, classic you as well. Even when we know better, even when we know that we shouldn't be pointing our fingers at other people when we've got so much wrong in our own lives, even when we know that our joy and contentment should be in Jesus, not in stuff. And even when we know that Jesus is our perfect example, the one who came not to be served, but to serve. Even when we know it's our pride that leaves us struggling. And I just think we'd do well to go away from today asking ourselves these three questions. And actually regularly asking ourselves these three questions so that we keep ourselves on a good track. Now, of course, Haman isn't the only character in this story. And I thought it might be worth our while having a glance at some of the others as well, starting with King Xerxes. Now, my goodness, the whole story of Esther doesn't paint a great picture of this guy, going right back to, I'm sure, what you've been covering in previous chapters. No need for me to rehash it, but what can we see in chapter 3 and what lessons can we take to heart? Well, already you know from chapter 1 that this guy was very powerful. He ruled over a vast amount of territories. You'll also know that his ego was a bit of an issue, especially when his first queen dared to defy him. Well, here in chapter 3, we get a pretty bleak picture of this man's character. I mean, for a start off, his discernment wasn't all that good. I mean, bad enough to appoint Haman without knowing what kind of character he was. But going further and insisting that others should kneel before him, he should have known that's not smart. Now, this was now his 12th year as king. You'd think he would have learned something and that his experience would have told him this wasn't smart, but obviously not. But what really stands out to me is that this King Xerxes was so blasé about people and about money. And it's summed up in these words: keep the money and do with the people as you please. I go on like, Xerxes, are you not listening to what Haman's been saying here? He's just offered you today's equivalent of £200 million. Were you not listening? Are you not interested in that kind of money? And he's just asked you to authorize the genocide of a whole people group. Do you not care? Have you not thought through the consequences of this? Would you not at least have a think about whether this sounds right or not? Apparently not. He was so wealthy, he didn't need the money. And he was so disinterested, he didn't care about the people. It just comes across as, do you know what? I'm doing great. Leave me alone with my comfort. I just want a quiet life. And he just couldn't be bothered. And finally, when it all kicked off and the edict has been published around the kingdom, here's what we read. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was bewildered. Here's the pair of them having a Guinness each, whilst the rest of the city's going, what on earth is going to happen? I'm pretty sure none of us are ever going to be in the position where we turn down £200 million. I'm also pretty sure none of us are going to be in a position where we're asked to give our approval to a genocide. But that doesn't mean that we don't have anything to learn from Xerxes. Let's just even consider a couple of things. Like that last part. Being totally out of touch with what was happening. Sometimes I wonder when I watch politicians and I hear other people spouting on TV if they have any idea what real life is like. You know the old saying that was allegedly attributed to Marie Antoinette when the people in Paris were starving to death. They didn't have enough bread and said, well, if they don't have bread, let them eat cake. And we can laugh at that. And maybe we can look a bit bewildered when a politician who's totally out of touch comes off with something equally embarrassing. But we all need to be careful. Michael actually covered this in his prayer earlier. We got to be careful that we aren't out of touch with how other people are. We're much more sensitive today to a day like Mother's Day when we realize that for all those who are celebrating, there's pain involved for others. And by the way, just as an aside, in the Sunday Times today, the Archbishop of Canterbury has written the most fantastic article, one of the best articles I've read in years, about his mother and his own experience of pain and forgiving her and what forgiveness looks like. I thoroughly recommend it. It's absolutely wonderful. But we need to be careful because we can be out of touch with our world and out of touch with people around us. Like compared to most of the world, my kids ask me, are you rich, Dad? And I'm going, compared to the vast majority of people on this planet, I am filthy rich. I'm not just rich, I'm filthy rich. And we need to remember that. But if we only compare ourselves to the rest of the world, we can lose sight of the fact that maybe people very close to us are facing real struggles. Even in church, when we organize stuff, maybe outings or weekends or whatever, and we think it's not very expensive, we may not be realizing that some people close to us find themselves in a shocking quandary. Because what seems a small price to some of us is actually outside their very carefully planned budget. Or, this is even more difficult, when we're really quick to take stances on moral issues, we run the risk of showing ourselves to be totally out of touch. Take something like pro-life issues. And that's something that many of us have very strong views on, and I would say rightly so, but I see a lot of this, given the amount of time I spend with colleagues in the US, where they've got very strong opinions on this issue. But ask them, okay, are you willing to pay a little bit extra on your tax? Are you willing to give a little bit more to support adoption or to provide care for single mums and their babies? and they disappear like snow off a ditch. Like, it's really easy to point the finger and not realize, ooh, I may not have worked out all of the consequences here. And it's really easy for us to point a finger at someone like King Xerxes for being out of touch, and we may not be too far off at ourselves at times. And as for his attitude to the money and the genocide, well, for sure, it's unlikely we're going to make those mistakes. But we also need to watch that we aren't relatively too comfortable in our own worlds to ignore the plight of those in need or those in danger. But it's his blasé reaction to it all. You know that, so I couldn't be bothered. That's maybe our greatest danger. It might be issues at home or in our community, in our country, in our church, in our workplaces. And we know there's something seriously wrong. But do you know what? I just couldn't be bothered with it. Leave it to someone else to sort out. Or even when we have to tackle tricky issues together. And you can't go through life without having to tackle tricky issues. You have to. You've got to learn how to do it. But are we prepared to do the hard yards in those relationships? Or are we just looking for the easy way out? I'm wondering if we often find ourselves caught between two extremes. Either we're ready to fight about everything, or we're ready to tackle nothing. Have a go at parenting teenagers, and you soon realize that neither of those is a good option. They don't work well. In fact, it's as we commit to tackling tough things together that we solve the problem of being out of touch. You see, from a distance, it's too easy to content ourselves with thinking there's a black and white stance on issues that are often way more complex than that. But it's as we commit ourselves to work through those difficult issues together that we start to see the other person's perspective. We start to understand their situation, and we realize in a much better way the challenges they have to face. And hopefully, we become a little more gracious and a little wiser, as opposed to being gloriously and dangerously aloof. So Haman and Xerxes, neither coming out of the story with any great credit, which leaves us just one more person, Mordecai. Although I think maybe we should look at him as representative of his people, the Jews. We're introduced to him briefly in chapter 2. Well, you should have been if Michael had finished the chapter, but I hear he didn't quite get there. But anyhow, he's going to become more prominent as things advance in the story. But we do see a few things that give us an insight to what it means to be the faithful people of God. One of them is in chapter 2. We read it earlier today in chapter 3, was his refusal to bow down to Haman. And it's not that God's people didn't give honor when it was due. In fact, when you read the stories of Daniel and his friends, or Nehemiah, and all around this general time, you can't fail to see just how respectful they were when they engaged with the rulers of the pagan lands where they were held captive. In fact, so much so, I believe they serve as a rebuke for the shocking way some Christians today behave in the public square. But that didn't mean they just went along with everything. They knew that there were things that they shouldn't do. Like Daniel and his friends, they refused to eat the king's food that had been offered to idols. Daniel refusing to stop praying to the Lord. And then the three friends refusing to bow down and worship the idol that Nebuchadnezzar had made. They knew there were things they shouldn't do. For Mordecai, his line was obviously bowing to Haman, and maybe it was because of those pagan associations. God's people should be the most respectful of all people. But we should also know the things that we shouldn't do. And here's another thing. Intriguingly, these are the words of Haman himself. part of his justification for getting rid of the Jews. He said, there is a certain people dispersed among the nations in all the provinces of your kingdom who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all other people, and they do not obey the king's laws. It is not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. That's fascinating, because much of it is actually true. But it's how that truth was twisted that makes it so insidious. Taking their differences and making it appear that it's their different customs that makes them a threat. It has happened time and again in history. If you think back to the early church and the trouble they faced, both from religious Jews and from Roman emperors, the spin that was put on it was that these people are threats to you. The truth was, as one early church father pointed out when he pleaded with Caesar, he said, don't kill these people. They are the best citizens you have. And it was the Christians who stayed whilst Rome was overrun by plagues and disease, caring for the needy, the best citizens of the city. But Haman was right. Their customs were different. And so they should have been. Because the God they served had taught them to love him and to love their neighbors. It was their God who had insisted they were to care for the poor, the orphan, the outsider, and the needy. It was their God who had impacted people like Daniel and others, that they came to be the best leaders their country could have. Or going back earlier in the Old Testament, a man like Joseph. And therein, to me, lies our challenge today when I look at Mordecai. Are we the best citizens our country has? Are we at the forefront of caring for the poor, the foreigner, the refugee, and the needy? Are we known for the contribution we make to society and to our community? Do our customs stand out? Are we different in ways that actually mean something? See, we've talked about knowing where we should draw our lines, but what I see in many of these Old Testament characters is this. It was their behavior and it was their engagement that they were most known for. It wasn't for drawing lines. They did have lines they wouldn't cross. For sure they did. But that wasn't where they started from. They started with their behavior. And yet sometimes I wonder, are we far more known for the lines that we draw? Are we far more known for the stances we take on issues rather than being known for the kind of people we are and known for the contribution we make to the community around us? See, remember even in this story, what has brought Mordecai to our attention? It's not that he refused to bow to Haman. The first time we hear about him is the story about how he foiled a plot on the king's life. He's not known primarily for what he refused to do. He's firstly known for the role that he played as a great citizen, even though he was in captivity. I'm pretty sure there's something in there that we could learn from. Got to finish. I'm going to finish with these words because I just read them the other day, and as I was thinking of this talk, I thought, wow, these fit so well. They're words from the Apostle Peter, and he was writing them to Christians who were suffering fearsome persecution. And as they were, he was encouraging them to be the right kind of people, not merely to have the right kind of beliefs and stances. And they challenged me. Let me read them, and we're done. Rid yourselves of all malice and all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and slander of every kind. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human authority, whether to the emperor as the supreme authority or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good, you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. Live as free people, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as God's slaves. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the family of believers. Fear God. Honor the emperor. If you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God. To this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps.